Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is A Responsible Day for the 24th of Tevet. Today we'll get a chance to meet Rav Israel Hildesheimer a little bit. Rav Israel Hildesheimer was born in 1820 in Halberstadt, Germany, and he passed away in Berlin in 1899, which would make you think he's a German Rav, and he was, a Sion, I don't know, something like that, S-C-I-O-N, meaning he was a descendant of a rabbinic family. He studied with Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, who we've seen, who wrote Binyan Sion. He studied with him in Altona, and apparently Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, the Binyan Sion, recognized him as his, according to Bar Ilan at least, as his foremost disciple. And then he learned also with Chacham Isaac Bernays, who's a really interesting figure because he is the Rebbe both of Rav Israel Hildesheimer and also of Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch, and yet he didn't leave anything in writing, so we really know very little about him. Although it is true that we know him from his students, so he's there with him. And then in this years that we're having this tshuva, he was from 1851 to 1869. He was a Rav in Eisenstadt, Hungary, which is, I checked it, like 150 miles from Budapest, which will come up in the tshuva, because the tshuva that we're going to see, the first of the two by Rav Israel Hildesheimer, the tshuva we're going to see is when he's written, living in Hungary, and he's writing to a man who lives in Budapest. Now, he was already, I think, a well-known Talmid Chacham, but what really made him famous was in 1874, at the age of 54, he established a rabbinical seminary in Berlin that later became known as Hildesheimer Seminary, and became famous throughout the world. It produces generations of rabbi scholars, communal leaders. That was where the Sri the Eish was the Rosh Yeshiva before it closed right up into World War II in 1940, I think, is when it finally closed when the Nazis came. He was also a very vigorous fighter against reform, and he was very invested in the budding Jewish community in Eretz Israel. He was known as the Prince of Eretz Israel, and that's his life. So he has a tshuva for the 24th of Tevet of, and he calls it Yom Gimel, the Tuesday, Chavdalet Tevet, 24th of Tevet, Divrei Habrit. So now, Divrei is just put in there because he wants to, but Habrit is supposed to be the year. So I would have thought Habrit meant, hey, tough race, you'd bet. But in fact, in Shuvot, they tend not to put the hey in, and the hey is here, the number. It's really tough race, you'd Zion. It's really 1857. So he's a 37-year-old man. He gets a letter from another man in Budapest. It's not clear that he's a rabbi. And the man who's writing him says, when I got your letter, and we don't know what that letter was, but when I got your letter, he says, I was busy because my father, who has since passed away, refers to him as Hareini Kaparat Mishkavo. The Lachat Shulchan Aruch is that for a year after a parent passes away, the children are supposed to, when they refer to the parent, say, Hareini Kaparat Mishkavo, my life should be an atonement for their repose. And then after that, you say, Zichron Levracha. So he says, my father was ill. My father, Hareini Kaparat Mishkavo, was ill, and then he passed away of that illness. So then I had to deal with all those issues. And then he says, it sounds like he's a Rav, but he spoke to the leaders of his community, he says, and I showed them your letter, and they all agreed that they can't make a new. Now, this is Hungary in 1857, and they're saying, so apparently Rav Israel Hildesheimer sent a letter recommending something. We'll see what it is. And they say, we can't do it unless, we're not going to make a new institution unless all of the rabbis get together. And if all the rabbis get together and they all agree that every community, and this is what it is, should be a chevra chizuk hadat. So let's remember who we're talking about. Rav Israel Hildesheimer is not a radical in any way whatsoever. He's certainly opposed to reform, but he's the man who sets up the Hildesheimer Seminary for Rabbanim, which is Rabbanim who are interested and invested in being able to cope with the modern world as well as being steeped in halachic literature. People bandy around centrist orthodoxy, modern orthodoxy, Torah Mada, Torah Derech Eretz, Torah Chochma, whatever the answers are. He was in that constellation of discussion that did not immediately reject that which was outside of Torah, outside of specific Torah. And yet, he is interested in saying, and he thinks that it's important that communities start having a chevra chizuk hadat. They have a, so that's a community whose job, that's a, not a community, it's a committee, it's a group whose job is to try to uphold better observance. Now, those kinds of committees have gotten, I think, sometimes a bad reputation because you hear sometimes of examples of such committees who go way too far. So you'll have, in some communities you'll have a vaad atznius, you'll have a committee whose job in some sense is to try to Tzitzis is a bad word, is a word I don't like because it's often used only about women's clothing when it means a tremendous amount more than just that. It means about just living life in privacy in general and not being overly flashy about our lives. But in any case, you'll have communities like that and they do all sorts of things that seem intrusive and extreme, and so you can think, well, so there's no value in it. But what Rav Hildesheimer is pointing out is that these things are a part of Jewish tradition. They just have to be handled with sensitivity and with care and well, and they tend not to be. So I mean, we know in our times they tend not to be, but that doesn't mean they shouldn't have. Rabbi Yonah, I know from my own readings, Rabbi Yonah in Shari Tshuva was very in favor of such things. The community should have people whose job it is to oversee what's going on and to make sure that what's going on is handled well in the Jewish community, is observing the Torah and caring about the Torah in the way that it's supposed to. So apparently, Rav Zil Hildesheimer has suggested this to this man in Budapest, and they said, then he went to his shul, and they said, well, we're not going to start it, but if everybody gets together and does it, then they'll do it as well. And he now says, and they've got a good point. He's saying that his community that's refusing to do this just because Rav Zil Hildesheimer suggests they do it, he says they have a good point, because this isn't the only reason why we would benefit from a gathering of the Rabbanim of the time. Because if they all got together, there's lots of things that need attending to. So I don't usually comment a lot on these kinds of these tshuvot. I mostly try to read and summarize them. But I think watching what's going on here, to me, is interesting in the sense that it's an idea comes up. It's an important idea. It's an important idea for this community itself. But they're unwilling to do it unless this whole broad community gets together, unless everybody does it. So I can understand the motivation for that. Here it's a little bit less clear because it's not so crazy to have a chevra chizuk adat, although if you imagine our times today and you wanted to start having an active group who are going to, in what we would call police, it's not the right word, but they're going to police others' observance, today that would not go over well. So if a community was thinking about doing it, they would say, well, we're not going to do it first because it's not going to go over well. If you get everybody to do it, then we'll do it. And I understand that motivation and that worry and that hesitation. But it's worth remembering that you might also then make it impossible. And if you make it impossible for it to happen, you're basically not doing something that you should be doing, even though it's a good idea. And that seems to be happening here. So the man who is in some kind of communication with Rav Zil Hildesheimer says, and by the way, they're right, because there's lots of issues that have to come up. So this, to me, reads like an example of the perfect being the enemy of the good, meaning that the perfect thing would be if all the rabbis finally got together and they could develop some kind of consensus, and then communities would listen or not listen as they chose to, but they would at least have clear directions to what they should be doing. But because you're not going to get a consensus like that, you're not going to get the rabbis together to talk about it, then you end up not even having anything going on, you're not having any of it. And this man is defending and saying, yeah, and I understand it because we really have many, many important problems. Unless we deal with all the problems, it's almost not worth doing. So the examples he gives are that people sell tefillin in the marketplace, and he says, la lafim, there are thousands of tefillin being sold. I don't know how many Jews there were to be selling thousands of tefillin, but they're selling tefillin that are psulim, that are invalid. He says, I've opened up many tefillin. So he says, I've opened up a lot of tefillin, and the letters are not well made. You don't have the right shape. Some of them don't have any shape at all, basically. And thousands of Jews. So he says, it's not enough that lo dai kar kafta de lo manchu tefillin. It's not enough that, so this is a phrase from the Gemara. The Gemara talks about, in Rosh Hashanah, we're talking about how people get judged. One of the things it says is that if you have a kar kafta de lo manchu tefillin, if you have a head that has never put on tefillin, so that gets a special punishment in Gan Eden. I mean, there are times when somebody is a Beinoni, is half good and half not good, and they get judged, and then once they're judged, it's all over, unless it's Karkafta Lo Manach Tefillin, unless it's a head that's never put on tefillin, and then you get a worse punishment. That's where the Gemara reads it. So that is the source of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Alav HaShalom's decision to have many of his shluchim, many of his kids, and his representatives try to get Jews to wear tefillin, because he thought that even if you get a Jew to wear tefillin once in their life, you've helped them in this sense of this Gemara. So that's what he invested in, and that's the source of that. for our letter's purposes, his point is that, so if it turns out that people are selling invalid tefillin, and you have Jews buying these tefillin thinking that they're valid, so one problem is they'll end up being a karkafta de lo manach tefillin when they didn't mean to. Another problem is that it's a bracha levatala. They're making brachos every day on tefillin that are invalid. It's a bracha that doesn't work and isn't take effect. It's not got a valid object, and that's a terrible thing. We very much at halacha try to avoid brachot levatala. And that's because, he says, there's no authority. There's no halachic authority. Everybody does what they want. There's nobody overseeing it. There's nobody who trains sofrim and has a standard for what it means to be a sofer. It's whoever wants to, whoever thinks they write well or they know well, and they just do it. So he says, if we could get together the rabbanim, the rabbis, in large numbers, and make rules, and the rules would be you don't buy tefillin unless you go to a sofer who's got some kind of authority. His example was he would go to three rabbis who know him, who know Mahuto, who know what he's like, and he says, Me'odo v'ad hayom. From birth, basically, meaning you want people who have, nowadays, for example, you can imagine somebody going to, there are certain rabbanim I know of, who if you want to get smicha, you go to them, they sit with you for a day or two, maybe, they talk to you a little bit, they give you a test, they find out you know some stuff, and they give you a smicha. So this man who's writing to Vizul Hildesheimer is suggesting that for tefillin purposes, we would need that he gets three rabbis who know him really for a long time and know the quality of the person and can authorize him to be a sofer, and that unless you have such an authorization, you shouldn't buy tefillin from them. And he also adds in, test him 10 times. And that comes from a couple of places. One is the tradition is that Avram was tested 10 times, and when Hashem punishes the Jews, he says, they tested me 10 times, and that's why I'm now punishing them. So that's the reference that he's making. But the guy who's writing to Rizal is saying you should have such standards for selling tefillin. So too with tzitzit, he says. Tzitzit are sold everywhere, and there's no stamp of hechsher on them. So I thought about that when I was reading this, and I realized that I'm not sure that we have so much of a hechsher today since I haven't checked. They say, they'll claim that they made them properly, but this man writing to Rizal Hildesheimer says we have no real way of knowing if they were made lishman. So in tefillin, the threads have to be wound, or whatever you do with threads, to make them lishman for the sake of making tzitzit. And we don't know that. We don't even know that it was Jews who did it and non-Jews. So he's saying we have to have some kind of authority on this. This, to me, also is a reminder that's still relevant to our times about the question of authority. Meaning today, if you talk about kashrut, so that's a place where you have lots and lots of authorities. And the question often becomes, how do you know which authority who's telling you that something is kosher is valid and who to follow and who not to follow? And there's not a lot of centralizing on that. Now, there are some places that would like to centralize it, but that's what's because they have a financial stake in it. I once actually said to somebody who was involved in a large kashrut organization, you know, why don't we just swallow up all these smaller kashrus and check with them what they're doing, make sure that they're okay, and give them the larger organization stamp. So let's say the larger organization, I'll make up a kashrus. Say I have a GR kashrus, right? A Gidon Rothstein kashrus, and let's say I already have thousands of people who are with me. And now I know that in lots and lots of small towns, the local rabbi gives a hashgacha. So he does it because he makes a living off of it because he's there on the ground. So I said, let the bigger kashrus just go to the small guys. And I said, listen, we're not going to change the financial arrangement at all. You'll keep the money that you keep. But if we talk to you and we agree that you're living up to our standards, then you'll continue. But we'll just start putting our kashrus stamp on it. So that's what was my idea. And the idea just to simplify kashrus, that the larger organization would take onto themselves that they would swallow up, not swallow up for the sake of swallowing it up, but for the sake that people all over the country could know better who it was. He says to me, well, we can't do that because we have to make a living too, so we can't just let them have all the money. So you end up having a million different hashgachos, and then you have a problem. So that's even more so for other ritual items, right? How do you know a lulav is kosher? How do you know an esrog is kosher? So in Israel, there are ways that there are central rabbinic organizations that will tell you these etrogim are kosher. But in other ritual items, we don't really have a way. You know, when it came time to buy tefillin for my sons, let's say, I called a friend and I said, do you know a good sofer? And he did. So we used him and it worked out fine and it was all good. But But it's an issue. And we went to Eretz Yisrael too, where some of this is more centralized. But as soon as you start centralizing things, let's be clear, then they also have authority. And then they'll start saying things that people might not like, because authority wields authority. So this man is suggesting we need to have authority be wielded, and that's what the problem is. And then he says it's also true that the government of Hungary has just, the monarchy of Hungary, in the last year, they've just said, you know, in Hungary we're going to take public funds, and we're going to make an educational fund, and we're going to teach teachers, right? It's like we're going to have a teacher training area, and we're going to do it for rabbis too. So he says, unless we take immediate action, then in the city of Pest, for example, which is half of Budapest, you might have people who don't really believe in the Torah, and they'll become the leading rabbis because they'll join this teacher training program, and then the government will install them in the job. So we need to get the rabbis of Hungary together, and maybe then we can convince the monarchy not to do it this way and to understand our sensitivities. He also says there's a lot of people who violate Shabbos and Yom Tov in public, and they open their stores, and they cook, and they do even prohibitions that are on a biblical level, and there's nobody stopping them, and we have no way to stop it. So he says if we went to the king as a group, they might even give us the power to punish such people. Maybe we tell them, this is our religion and they're not keeping it, whatever, we might have the power. Now, I'm not sure that he's right about this as a technical matter, what was true in Hungary at the time, but that's what he's claiming is. So he says, and there's lots of things, then he adds, and there are many more things that there are things, I think, that are apparently either too sensitive. So you got to wonder if he's already talking about Chil Shabbos, and he's talking about Chil Yom Tov, he's talking about selling tefillin without a hechsher, and he's talking about all sorts of things, right? And there's something he can't write. So we have to talk about these things, he says. So we have to find people who will do this, and he says, and I don't know who else, and I think he suggests that Israel Hiltzheimer might be the person who could actually put it all together. So he says in earlier generations they would work for Kiddush Hashem, and now we watch people violating the Torah in public and we don't do anything about it. It's an insight into the state of Judaism in Hungary in 1850, you know, whatever we're talking about, 1857, we said. So you wonder about, that's the state of religiosity in Hungary and in Germany, and these are the Jewish communities that we're talking about. So that's the first step of it. Then he gets into some actual Torah. So that was a first step of what he's talking about. And then he says, I was learning a sugya. And so he ends the letter with a sugya, and that's what the part of it that Rizul Hildesheimer is going to respond to, and the part that we're going to spend the rest of our time on. But to watch it, as far as we know, he doesn't respond to this tshuva about, to the stuff about this. He doesn't respond in this tshuva anyway to the questions about what to do about getting the community together. It could be that there was no way to get a community together. I have no idea. But that part doesn't get. So this is the Katan Shimon Nadas, and he doesn't live in Budapest. He lives in Chernoya. But in any case, that's the letter. Now he says, I also have started to learn the sugya of Hazmana. So the sugya of Hazmana Halacha, we're not coming to conclusions about it, but it's an important, interesting sugya, so we'll get some discussions of it here between them, because he says, I've started to learn the sugya of Hazmana, and I want some help with it. So the sugya of Hazmana is, this is true on both sides of the halachic coin. In the case of something that is prohibited, it's going to be prohibited, or in the case of something that is going to be kadosh, something that's going to be extremely important for halacha, when does it become that item? So, for example, a shul, when is a shul a shul? So you gather bricks for a shul. Are they now yet completely dedicated to the shul, and therefore you have to treat them with whatever rules you have to treat the shul? That would be one possibility. So that's the question of hazmana. When is it that something is dedicated to its purpose? That would be true the other way as well. Let's say something is prohibited for being an idol of idol worship or something like that. When does that count as hazmana? And that's the question of the answer. He started learning the sugya of hazmana, and I'm learning it, and he says, and I don't understand, the Gemara there says that Abaye tells us that if somebody is ha'oreg beged lemeit, somebody weaves a shroud, basically, weave some clothing for a person who has passed away, below ha'omer beged zelamet, So Abaye derives from that that just saying something is not considered hazmana. You need the act of ariga, the act of weaving the clothing, and then once it's woven, it is now already a shroud. Now that's an important point, meaning I have somebody who's passed away and I weave the shroud, I make it for them, then already it, even though I haven't used it for them yet, I haven't put it on them, it's already been dedicated to them. But Abaye's point is that just saying it wouldn't have been good enough. If I say, I am going to make this item now for the person who's passed away, that's not yet enough to dedicate it to them with all the halachic ramifications thereof. And in the case of Egla Arufa as well, so an Egla Arufa, let's remember, is if a corpse is found between two cities, and you don't know who killed the person, it's not just a corpse, they have a murder victim, and we don't know who killed them, so the closer city is required to bring a korban, is required to bring a sacrifice to atone, because it was their job to make sure that they took care of the people who passed through their midst, and since this is closest to them, we assume the person came from there, and therefore it's our obligation to undertake that they are at fault, and they bring a heifer, an egla arufa, a young cow, and they break the cow's neck, and then they have a whole ceremony over it. I once wrote a book called Murder of the Mikdash, and I discussed it there, and I gave an example. I sort of tried to portray it there and how it might have worked. But the point is, in our Gemara, it's not considered the Egla that's going to get the Arifa, that's going to have its neck broken, until it's brought down into the Nachal Eitan, until it's brought down into the place where you're going to break its neck and bury it there. But if you just say it's going to be an Egla Rufa, it's not yet got the halachic status of the Egla with the Isser Hano, with the prohibitions getting benefit from it. So the question is, how could Rava, the question of the man asking the question is, how could Rava disagree, since after all, Rava is learning it from Avodah Zarah. Rava says Avodah Zarah, idolatry, we see happens just with saying it. If you say, I want this item to be an item of Avodah Zarah, just saying it will be good enough. Such as, I want to use this ox as a sacrifice for Avodah Zarah, or this house is going to be a place of Avodah Zarah. So there too, Abaye would agree, the man asking the question is, because when it comes to Avodah Zarah, just saying it is obviously good enough, because that has to do with the special rule of idolatry. So the question is, how could Rava get the idea that there's a general principle of hazmana, that something is considered dedicated to its purpose, if, after all, his example is Avodah Zarah? Avodah Zarah is an exception that does that just because one can actually perform Avodah Zarah with just saying it. If somebody says to an item, you are my God, you shouldn't say this, I'm not, this is just an example. God forbid, the person says, you are my God, you are the power that rules my life, that's already an act of Avodah Zarah. So the fact that an act of Avodah Zarah can be verbal would mean then that the idea that I could prepare something for Avodah Zarah verbally is not relevant to our general discussion of Hazmana. This is the question that the man is asking to Rabbi Zviel Hildesheimer. Then he also points out that it seems like the flow of the sugya is that if we didn't have any sources about it, we would assume that hazmana is lav milta. Hazmana lav milta would mean that there is no way that before an item is actually being used for its purpose, there's no way that it would be actually be considered part of its purpose, meaning, I say I'm going to use these bricks to build a shul, they have no halachic status of bricks for a shul yet. Right, that would be what I would be suggesting. Right, there would be no halachic status. That would be hazmana lav milta. So that's the word seems to assume is the general impression. The reason why I think we would think that is because until you've done something with something, you haven't done it yet. So if you haven't done it yet, you haven't done it yet. So why would it be that that we would hold another way? And then once a buyer is going to say no, but I have sources that say hazmana is a milta, hazmana does count for something, then why wouldn't a buyer do it only in terms of the dead, and he learns it with Gzeira Shava from Egla Arufa, but in both those cases, there's special rules that apply there. The dead, you could say you learn it from Egla Arufa, but maybe it only applies there. Why wouldn't I learn it narrowly and stick with my general assumption that hazmana lav milta, that hazmana doesn't count? Also, he points to another source of Abaye's in Shabbos Mimdalet Amid Bet. Then he also raises another sugya in Shabbos where Abaye talks about a new candle. In the case of a new candle, so remember, in the time of the Gemara, candles meant clay containers for the oil and wicks that you'd have. So there it seems like hazmana doesn't work, even though Abaye thinks that hazmana is milta. So there, if you had an action, I would have thought that Abaye should say it. So he has that question there. So let's, we only have a little bit of time left. We spent most of the time not on Rizal Hildesheimer. So let's just see his answer a little bit here. So in the parts of the answer, the answer is very brief and mostly refers to his Chidushim on Sanhedrin, and you don't get into the whole sugya. But one of the points he makes is that when it comes to Arigat, to weaving a shroud, you have to think, and it might be Machlokes Rashi and Tosfos there, is what he says, that Arigat might be that that counts as a ma'aseh, and that when Abaye says hazmana is a milta, Rashi thinks it means because there's an action there. But there are others who held that ariga, just weaving, isn't actually a ma'aseh, and that in fact, Rashi, and in fact, Abaye holds when he says hazmana milta, he holds it even without a full ma'aseh. You don't need a full action. Maybe it might be that speaking doesn't work fully, but they're speaking with even a minimal act. It's not quite an act, but some kind of minimal act is what hazmana qualifies as. So those are questions to raise in the sugi of hazmana. So he goes on with that a little bit. The truth is, he doesn't bring complete clarity to the discussion. He gives him a couple of examples, and he refers him to his Kedushim and Sanhedrin, and then we can learn that another time. But it's a first introduction for Israel Hildesheimer, and then the time we have left, I found another tshuva of Israel Hildesheimer's, also from the 24th of Tevet, but this is from later in his life, from Tav Resh Lamed Gimel, from 1873, when he's on the verge of creating the Hildesheimer Seminary. I apologize, that was completely the wrong world, the rabbinical seminary that trained Rabbanim for almost 70 years in Berlin. So he says, I got your letter previously, and I wanted to respond, but I didn't have a time because I was very busy with various things from all that I was working on. And he says, my usual things, v'shiurim t'midim k'zirim, and I gave a lot of shiurim, and I'm already, in other words, even before he has the seminary, he's already teaching lots of things in the community, so he's very busy. So he now got to his letter, which is about Maaser Ksafim. So Maaser Ksafim means when you earn money, there's a long-standing tradition or an obligation to give a tenth of that money to tzedakah. So he says it's not clear. There's a lot of stuff that's not clear about that obligation. We today have already, people have written books about it for that exact reason. But he says, I have it in my mind that I want to write a book about it. I want to write an article, he says, about it, but I haven't yet got. So for now, I'm just going to use some very brief insight or direction. He says the source for Maaser Ksafim, for giving a tenth of our money to tzedakah, he says, is Sifrei, which is quoted in a Tosfos in Ta'anit on Daf Tet, and we're in Ksubos that has it as well. There's a Bavli in Yerushalmi, and it says, according to the Bavli, according to our Gemara, L'shas Didan, it sounds like you have the permission to give up to a fifth of one's money, from a tenth, but up to a fifth, whereas the Yerushalmi sounds like it's appropriate and it's proper to give a fifth the first time you make money, right? A fifth of whatever money you have, meaning in those days, you'd have your assets, what you really own, and then you'd have what you make off of that in the future. So you'd have your capital, basically, and then everything you earn in interest or in profit, so you give a fifth from your capital to begin with, and then after that, you give whatever you profit, you also give a fifth. So Yerushalmi sounds like, it stands from Asert Asrenu, a tenth of it and a tenth. Yaakov Avinu says, if you take care of me, Aser Asrenu Lach, I'll give a tenth. So Aser would mean a tenth, Asrenu would mean another tenth. So Yerushalmi sounds like you're supposed to give a fifth if you can. So then there's opinions about whether it says, Yaakov says it, Aser Asrenu. So does that mean it's a biblical obligation? Or is it a rabbinic obligation? And they're just using that pasuk, or is it just a custom? The Ma'aril, quoted in the Ramah in Yeridea Resh Mem Tet, seems to have held that it was Doraita. There was a biblical obligation. The Bach, quoted in the Taz, felt that it's not even a Durabanan, it's just a custom. Whereas the Taz thinks that it's a Durabanan. So you have all the three options as to what it is, but it is at least a long-standing custom. But they all agree that it's an obligation, right, that every Jewish, they think it's on a man. It's unclear to me why they're sure that if a woman were to be, I think in their times women weren't making money, but it's unclear if a woman was making money why she shouldn't also have to give it, maybe because we learned it from Yaakov Avinu. But in any case, when you have money, if Hashem gives you money, you're supposed to give. So he takes it that everybody agrees that the Yerushalmi is a chomesh, at the very least a tenth. And then he says that the Shla says that he thinks it's even, this is why I was struck by this tshuva as well, somebody was asking me about it, even if you earn it, even if you get an inheritance. Let's suppose I inherit $1,000. So the person I inherited from already gave Maaser Ksafim, already tithed it, already gave a tenth of it to tzedakah, because he's also a good Jew. So you think, therefore, this money is now already free and clear of that obligation, but the Shlah held that wasn't true. The Shlah held that the person who gets the money also, for that person, it's new money. So if it's new money for that person, so then he also should give. So he says, let's say the person's inheriting it from his parent, from his father. So we have an halacha, the idea that a son basically sort of replaces the father when he passes away. So you might have thought that if the son is just replacing the father, and the father gave the money to Tzedakah already, the son wouldn't have to. The Shlah nevertheless felt that the son is a new reshut, new ownership. When the father was alive, they didn't share their money completely. It's a new ownership, and therefore you have to give a tenth from it. So that is a little bit of a Zil Hildesheimer, seeing him involved in the community of Hungary, being involved in trying to support and to promote better Torah observance in the communities in Hungary. And then we see him, and then discussing also halakhic issues and Torah issues, we saw an example of hazmana, an example of when items are considered prepared and dedicated to the purpose that the person eventually intends to use them for. And then we saw later in his life, on the verge of him creating the rabbinical seminary that became known by his name, we see him discussing some issues of ma'aser kzafim, of the obligation to give a tenth, according to Yerushalmi, even a fifth, to tzedakah, and that even from monies that we inherit. So these are some of the issues that we see in Rabbi Zvi Hildesheimer's life for the 24th of Tevet, and that is a responsible day for the 24th of Tevet. Have a good day.